Thanks for listening to the Best of the Doug Gottlieb Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday from 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time, that's 12 to 3 Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Doug Gottlieb Show at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the Best of the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio.
Boom! What up, America? Doug Gottlieb Show, Fox Sports Radio. Coming to you from the wonderful city of Los Angeles, California. We cover all the sports, all the topics that you want to know about. Man, we got a great show planned for you. 877-99 on Fox is, of course, the phone number. At Gottlieb Show is the Twitter handle. And you can tell a friend. And don't be afraid to also, you can download the podcast, which comes out after every show. We have some unique content on our other pods as well. But the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio is brought to you by Farmers. At Farmers, we've seen almost everything, so we know how to cover almost anything when it's game time. Have an experienced player help you stay ahead of the game. Put their experience into play at farmers.com.
We are Farmers. Bum, ba, da, bum, 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 bum.
Now, look, I'm going to sit here and tell you that not every decision that was made, even by the Warriors late, was the right decision. But I don't, and I think they didn't get the benefit of a couple of calls late. There was a deflection and what led to a steal by Fred VanVleet. And if you watch the replay, there was a foul called on Steph Curry where VanVleet not only stole the ball, ran through a pass, but then he pushed Curry to try and go get the ball, and they called a foul on Curry. Curry had the ball late. You're up a bucket, and the Raptors fouled him. There was no foul being called. He finds a way to get it to Livingston, who comes to the basketball and just barely takes it away from the claws of Kawhi Leonard. Passes it to Andre Iguodala, who didn't have to shoot with that much time on the court, but clock, but he did, and he makes the dagger three, and the Warriors tie the series at one apiece. Like, we could get into the little things within the series, but here's my biggest and most important takeaway, and this is really, really important. Okay, this is really, really important. If you watched that game and you realized just how much better the Warriors were in the second half, are we ever going to say anything other than, man, Steph was great in the third quarter? He was bad to start the game and he was great in the second quarter. And then the third quarter, they kind of figured some stuff out. Has there ever been a human being in charge of a team who's gotten less credit, respect, adulation, or discussion than Steve Kerr? Guys, I watched the same game you did. And I would grant it, and this like, if you don't know me, that might they may sound like a DB thing to say, but I have a higher basketball acumen than most of you. So you may not have come away with the same thought that I did, which is that was a coaching mismatch, and the adjustments that the Warriors made, the substitution pattern and rotation and plugging holes when you don't have your best player and you didn't have your best defender for a good portion of the game, who's your second best player currently on the roster or currently playing. Like, that was amazing. And at least a good portion of it was coaching. Has there ever been anybody who gets less discussion than Steve Kerr? Right, the Raptors didn't score their first basket until 6:20 remaining in the third quarter. I'm willing to admit that the Warriors not making shots in the first half, having to adjust, and then Steph finally hitting some shots in the first half, they were feeling better. Some of it is on the players, but we don't give anything to the adjustments that were made at halftime and the coaching moves? Like, think about that for a second. That's all kinds of crazy. And by the way, they won in spite of the fact that Andre Iguodala's three-point shot, which was a little bit early on the clock, was the only shot the Warriors made in the last 5:39 of the game. They won that game because of the adjustments they made at the defensive end of the floor. And some of the adjustments they made offensively to the varying defenses of the Raptors, and some of it did, and some of it did not work. You didn't have Klay late. You didn't have KD. Even the decision to start DeMarcus Cousins last game and play him more minutes than his play probably earned might have been what won them the game. Because DeMarcus Cousins had a huge impact on the game. Late, he was gassed and he couldn't really help you. But he was able to give them some offense, which they so desperately needed, especially when Klay Thompson was out. And that is coaching. Adjustments are coaching. Sticking together when things are bad is coaching. Spreading out a team and reading their defense, coaching. Figuring out the problem and finding a solution at halftime is coaching. I get it. Luke Walton had a great... This is no different than the with KD, without KD, without Steph. This is no different than that discussion. You can show me the record of Luke Walton and these Warriors, and I can tell you that that doesn't mean anything to me. That was a different time. It was a important time where this team was just light years better than everybody they're playing. Plus, it's regular season basketball, which nobody really cares about. And in the postseason is about matchups and adjustments. And then, of course, you got to make some shots. And in spite of the fact they didn't make any shots over the last 5.5 minutes of the game, they still won on the road without Kevin Durant, without Klay Thompson. And I don't hear anyone saying, you know, Steve Kerr's kind of awesome. Kind of awesome. We do this thing with Phil Jackson. We're like, yeah, no, Phil Jackson always had the two best players. Like, okay. Jordan didn't win a championship before he got there. Pippen and Jordan were there. Kobe and Shaq didn't win anything until he got there. And then when he left, he didn't win anything. When he came back, they won again. It's weird how that works. Strange. The adjustments he made were magnificent. He made Draymond Green into kind of like a free safety. He took Steph some and put him into ball screens and changed the spacing, set some back screens, got some layups, changed what they were doing, and the Raptors didn't even know what hit them. You had an inexperienced coach versus an experienced head coach. And look, I'm actually personally friends with Nick Nurse. I played for Nick Nurse in the USBL. I've known him for almost 20 years. And he does have experience as a head coach overseas in the G League. But in the NBA, in the playoffs, that sucks. Life comes at you really, really fast. And there is a reason that it's the same. Coaching is a little bit like two things. A little bit like refereeing, and it's a little bit like what's called a 50-50 ball. Refereeing from this perspective. Like the greatest coaches are the ones where you almost don't know they're there. Don't get me wrong, Steve Kerr, you know, could not have made Sean Livingston go and catch that ball and pass to Andre Iguodala, and he could not have made Andre Iguodala shoot that last shot. But the reason that they had the spacing that they had, the reason that they were in the places that they were, it's like this, you know, like people are, well, wow, Steph really comes down, he looks to shoot, then he passes, then he becomes an off guard, and they set, like, all of this stuff is planned out. In football, we give all the credit in the world to Bill Belichick. We don't do any of it in basketball, it feels like. You know, they're just a well-oiled machine. Why do you think they're a well-oiled machine? They're not just out there winging it. They're like, we just go up there and wing it. No. I mean, Steve Kerr even told you after last game, hey, we don't see him very much, and now that we've seen him, we got a kind of a book on him, we'll make some adjustments, and they did. Here's Zaza Pachulia, who's been their starting center the last 2 years. He joined us Friday on the show. I asked him, like, Steph is amazing, but doesn't strike me as a true vocal leader. KD doesn't strike me as a true vocal leader. Draymond strikes me as a talker, but maybe not a leader. Who's the actual leader that makes this thing work?
You know, I would say Steve Kerr. You know, that's the guy who motivates everybody and, you know, who makes sure everybody's on the board. Obviously, you have the players like, you know, Steph and KD and Klay and Draymond who are playing big meeting. Steve did such a great job to get the guys motivated and ready and physically and mentally. So I would say Steve is the guy who keeps everybody together.
So he keeps everybody together, right? He keeps everybody together. He puts them in the right places. They play through DeMarcus Cousins. They change what they're doing. Remember, like, people talk about Golden State with the high ball screens. I don't know if how many of you know this. The Golden State Warriors set the fewest number of ball screens of any team in the league. But they changed that last night. Why? Because you take what the defense gives you. Steve Kerr is maybe the best coach I've ever seen. He doesn't overreact to negativity. He knows how to motivate different guys differently. And, oh yeah, by the way, nothing gets by him. Maybe it helps that he's been a broadcaster, a player, a bench player, a starting player, on championship teams, a general manager, and he's been outside of basketball. But whatever it is, I'm blown away by the adjustments, by the team's ability to kind of put a finger in the dike as it looks like it's all going to implode. You're playing on the road against a really good team that has a ton of self-confidence. You're down big in the first half. You're having to play bench players you never thought you'd play at this particular point. You've only played DeMarcus Cousins one time since he hurt his quad muscle. And at halftime, you make defensive adjustments where the team can't score for the first half of the third quarter, and you go on this incredible run to where now they're fighting an uphill battle. If you don't think coaching plays at least a substantial portion in what the Warriors have done over the past 5 years, you're contradicting everything we know about sports.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at noon Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Ethan Strauss covers the Warriors and the NBA for The Athletic. You can follow him on Twitter at Sherwood Strauss. Check out his latest from last night's game. Andre Iguodala, the curmudgeon and future Hall of Famer, delivers again for the Warriors. I want to discuss that future Hall of Famer thing with you in a second, but I started the show discussing the fact that I almost think no one, I mean, outside of me, I have seen a couple people pointed out, but not necessarily prominent TV. Like, Steve Kerr's kind of an amazing coach. They made ridiculous adjustments in both personnel and strategy throughout that night and from game one to game two. Am I alone thinking no championship coach has ever gotten less credit than Steve Kerr?
I think the signing of Kevin Durant might have taken from Kerr's credit, which is ironic considering that Kevin Durant joined the Warriors in part because he wanted to join up with the Steve Kerr style of basketball. But yeah, that has happened. And I will say, I will admit, I was at my media seat looking over to my right, my colleague Marcus Thompson, and I was ripping some of Kerr's moves, but they kept working. I said, I don't know about this whole starting DeMarcus Cousins thing. Now, after a certain point, they were so battered and bruised, they needed DeMarcus Cousins, and there was no choice in the matter, especially after Looney went down. But, hey, it worked out. A lot of the adjustments worked. Getting Andre Iguodala off of Kawhi, for instance, worked, and until Klay got hurt, putting him on Kawhi, that was effective. And it seems as though he has done a lot of quirky things. He has a lot of capital. He isn't scared. That's the thing. I think a lot of other coaches are scared. I think with Steve Kerr, he could walk away. He could do something else. Back with the Phoenix Suns, one day he just got up, he left, and he drove from Arizona to San Diego, and that was that. So when you have that confidence where you love it but you don't need it, you can try some quirky things, and some of those things can work out.
Okay, so you mentioned a couple of them. I mean, it is amazing, right? Like, we're only pointing out he didn't have Klay for a portion of the game, didn't have KD the whole game, didn't have Looney, and, you know, Cousins was awful in game one, and he believed him in game two, and that faith. And I think playing him in game one got his kind of feet wet, whatever, and got him to kind of work through some kinks as well. But what are some of the other quirky things that you've seen?
Well, I think let's talk about the general strategy of it. Now, I haven't discussed this with him. I discussed some things with him last night as to the why of Cousins. I know our Kim Kawakami wrote up the decision and how they came to it. But I have to wonder if a lot of it was that Toronto was playing up on the Warriors very aggressively, trying to take away the outside shot. And Cousins is somebody who excels, and even in this state where he might not be in peak shape and peak form, he's good at hitting cutters. So I think they specifically put him there with that in mind, and man, it seemed to be effective, especially in that third quarter stretch. So it wasn't just playing a guy. It was playing a guy with a sense of we are doing it because there's a collective strategy that he is integral to that fits with the defense that is facing us.
Ethan Strauss joining us in the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. And then the Iguodala thing is amazing, right? Like, he's playing on one leg. He probably shouldn't have shot that last shot, or at least that early in the shot clock. There was a couple seconds left where he could have held it. And yet, here's that same guy who won them the first championship when people dared him to shoot. They dare him to shoot again, and he makes them pay again. It is, hey, you go back to game six versus the Rockets. I pointed this out. It had been since 2013, I think, that he had made more than four threes in a game. And it was one time. He makes five threes in a game for the first time in, what was that, 6 years? And he does so in game six on the road. He does have this remarkable ability to have what people call competitive greatness, right? Being great when great was called upon. It's kind of he's an amazing guy.
He does. I think he's a unique individual. He's one of the most bizarre athletes in terms of quotes I've ever been around. It's always fascinating. You never know what you're going to get. I think what helps him is that he is big on process over results. He's big on shrugging and saying the game tells you to shoot, you shoot. That's the easy part. Some of the other things that require real decisions to be made in a split second, that's the hard part. And if it goes in, it goes in. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. But the game tells me to shoot, so that's what happens. So he does seem to have a quality to come up big when they need him and to punish teams when they say somebody besides Steph or Clay or KD needs to beat them. So it's been a remarkable career, and he is, and defensively, it's just impossible to overstate his value defensively. And it's half the game, but we don't treat it like half the game for whatever reason. We just say, come on down, Carmelo Anthony, obvious Hall of Famer. I'm not saying that he shouldn't be, but I'm just saying that there's no consideration. It's utterly bizarre. You know, nobody makes the argument that Ben Wallace, even though he might have been the greatest defensive player of his era, and defense is half the game, more so for a big man, because your responsibilities are disproportionately defensive in that era when you're a big guy near the rim versus Steve Nash, where your responsibility is to run the offense. But we just act like it's this just weirdo, like, little niche of the game, as opposed to literally half of it.
It's honestly, Ethan, welcome to my world. passing has always been that as well. And now passing and defense, really, I've had, Nick Wright's a friend of mine. I like him. I love how much he loves this sport. But he like told me, like, look, it's really 70% offense. It's like, no, it's not even close to that much, right? Literally, this is not 3-on-3, you know, basketball they used to have in the Midwest for girls basketball, where, you know, three girls don't actually leave one end of the floor. You have to play both, and we got to cover for our weakest link. And it's pretty amazing on how much we underwrite. Now, Hall of Famer, though, is a big, that's a big step. That's a big step, because he is open for a reason. He hasn't shot well in the regular season. He was a big scorer earlier in his career, but to very limited success in terms of when basketball really matters. Would that mean that Derek Fisher's a Hall of Famer? Wouldn't that mean that Robert Horry is a Hall of Famer?
I think it's a hard call, because in the NBA, and it's the Basketball Hall of Fame overall, the standard, let's face it, is a bit lower than it is for the other sports. And often when fans have these arguments, they're operating from a framework of football. They're operating from a framework of baseball. They're not thinking about basketball, where a Dennis Johnson gets in, or a Dollar Bill Bradley. You know, some of these guys where they didn't have superstar resumes. It's not that kind of sport. And I believe in the NBA, if you've had the kind of career he has had, where you go from being a franchise guy to being a fixture of an integral part of an enduring dynasty, either, you know, the greatest dynasty of the post-Celtics era, or second to the Bulls, You know, this is big stuff, and you have a Finals MVP. At that point, and I also believe there is going to be a cultural shift. There's just more study of basketball now. I think there's more of an understanding and appreciation for his impact, other than calling him a role player. So I believe you'll get there, as Zach Lowe has said, and Bill Simmons and some other people. But we'll have to check back in a few years. Maybe these voters won't want to vote for him because he doesn't seem to really care one way or the other.
Doug Gottlieb Show here on Fox Sports Radio at Sherwood Strauss. He's Ethan Strauss. He covers the Warriors and the NBA for The Athletic. Clay has said he's going to play, but I don't know how you know on your hamstring until you know on your hamstring. And then you have KD. You think KD plays in game three?
I can't really predict that. You know, he had the shoot around. He wasn't jumping. They were mostly set shots. How close, how far he is, hard to tell. I will say that who knows when it comes to Clay, but man, he was in pain last night. In the locker room, he was in the corner and he was grunting and he was yelling. And he doesn't betray a lot of pain. He's not an emotive guy, but he seemed to be in some serious, just a bad way with the way he was yelling. I don't know how to project what that is. I just know that it was a different kind of thing than, say, Kevon Looney walking out there saying, yeah, it hurts, and having the ice pack on his shoulder. Clay was laboring. But then again, Clay's so strange. He walked out of the arena under his own power. I have no idea why crutches weren't involved. So he's grunting and screaming in pain like he's going through labor, and then he walks out. He's a strange guy. I know that's not a satisfactory answer. You know, it's an I don't know, but I'm just trying to give you a little bit of the scenes from last night.
No question. Ethan Strauss joining us on the Doug Gottlieb Show. What about the Raptors? How devastating was that? Like, I know that every loss, and these guys are professionals, and their ability to, like, process, okay, if Clay doesn't play and KD doesn't play, like, boy, I don't know. That's a lot, no matter if they're playing in Oakland or they're playing on the moon. But that loss felt like a loss and a half, right? You had complete control. You had Curry under wraps. And even though Curry got it going at the end of the first half, I felt like, all right, we got this thing. We've got them figured out. And then all of a sudden, you can't score for the first half of the third quarter. And then Clay goes down and you still lose at home. How devastating do you believe this loss will be for the entirety of the series?
Well, it's certainly a deflating loss, but part of why it's deflating is also part of why you wouldn't say, oh, they'll never recover, because the Warriors are so banged up. I mean, if you're on the Raptors side, you go, okay, let that one get away. But, you know, ultimately at this juncture, they're the healthier team. They have more bodies to work with. It's a little concerning for them, the absence of a reliable playmaker or scorer beyond Kawhi Leonard. You know, there are guys who do it in spurts, right, where you got your Van Fleet or your, you know, when Lowry is playing better, it can certainly happen. But in the half court, there's not a lot of reliable options there. And that seems to really be hurting them when they need a bucket. The other thing that nobody's talking about it, but I can't help but notice it. It's not really my beat, not really what I'm writing about, but I'm just noticing it in clip after clip, is that Kawhi Leonard, maybe it's because he's hurt, and maybe it's because he has such a burden on offense where he is a beast. But defensively, there are a lot of plays he's making where if you put a beard on him and a Rockets jersey, people will be laughing at him on the internet. You know, he's not been good defensively in this series, in the first two games, to a degree that's a little bit shocking to me, considering the reputation. And yeah, you'll see every now and again he'll make some play like that intercepted Draymond pass, but I just keep watching, and when he goes up on Steph waltzes right by him a lot of the time. It's odd.
Well, that's not, I mean, as much as he's a great defender, that's not a position or that's completely, you know, like, I know, I understand he has the reputation of being able to guard 1 through 5, but that's a really, really hard, it's hard for anybody, right?
Yeah.
It just is. So I don't give him a total pass, and I agree with what you're saying, right? Sometimes guys' reputations as a defensive player is better than the actual defensive player there is. And then sometimes it's the, you know, it's the opposite of it. Like, I think Steph has a terrible reputation as a defender, and he's better than people give him credit. He's not great, and they try and hide him.
And to be clear, Kawhi Leonard, when he broke out as a player with the Spurs was an awesome defensive player and a terrifying defensive player and still somebody you have to worry about. But I just don't see the red. And, you know, it should be noted, his last two full seasons of basketball, the team he played for did better defensively when he was on the bench. And there are a lot of, you know, explanations for that. And, you know, there's variance and randomness, and sometimes the shots go in and sometimes they don't. I just kind of think he became more of a scorer who still looks like the defensive player people remember. That's just one observation. We'll see what it means going forward. They overall played a pretty decent defensive game plan, but it's just surprising from the guy who is touted as the most impactful defender on that team that you just don't see it.
Doug Gottlieb Show here on Fox Sports Radio. Okay, so you're the guy who got called out. You're writing a book early in the year. But I'm watching this thing, and I don't know. Maybe I take too much into it. I feel like this is, and if they win this thing, this would be amazing, right? Like, everybody's going to say, well, look at the guys they have. But, like, KD's not healthy. Even if he plays, that's not 100%. You know, Steph's carrying a ton of the burden, and, you know, he just a high volume of touches, not really the way, as much as he wants to play this way. Klay's now hurt. You know, Draymond actually hasn't shot the ball well after shooting it well in the last series. And then you got, you know, DeMarcus, who was awful in game one, better in game two. And then, you know, I've seen that video of Klay and KD waiting for all their teammates to come back in the locker room. And is there any way in your mind that the achievement of overcoming the injuries and overcoming the outside noise changes what Kevin Durant thought he wanted to do before the playoffs or finals began?
Man, that's a great question. I would say probably not, if I had to guess. I don't think that such decisions are in that high degree of variance. And when decisions are of that level of import, there's usually a little bit of predetermination, but you never know, right? You never know. And who knows what narrative this sets up? Who knows? Maybe Kevin comes back and he is not only a Willis Reed, but a Willis Reed with a superstar's impact. And he gets all of the love and people remember how essential he is. And maybe that sways things. It's really hard to tell at this juncture. I would say that it's not going to ultimately matter, but again, as somebody who has been yelled at for, I don't know, telling him what he's thinking or what have you, I don't think I was doing that, but I don't want to presume. I don't want to not only psychoanalyze, but psychoanalyze in the future, right? That's two things. That's two projections on top of each other.
The article is Andre Iguodala, the curmudgeon and future Hall of Famer, delivers again for the Warriors. Before I let you go, you mentioned some of the quotes, and if you read the piece, there's one quote, "I don't care, one day you're replaced," then some other MF-er is in there, and another after that, "nobody remembers anything, none of it matters." But he also said something about he wanting to win for Steph Curry on how he's viewed at by his peers. That one kind of came out of nowhere, didn't it?
It did. I asked him what motivates him at this juncture because he always gives interesting existential responses, and that's what he said. Now, there's always the question with Andre, how much does he mean it? How much is it tongue-in-cheek? I think he does like Steph. I think he does want to help Steph. Is that his sole reason for playing? Is that his sole motivation? I don't think that's true. I don't. But it's interesting that he's saying it. And with him, He likes to play in the gray zones. He likes to be in that space where you're not totally sure if he's kidding. You're not completely sure what is the truth and what is just there to get a rise out of you. And in a way, it's a little refreshing because he's just somebody who's so amused with the process. He's not worried about a brand. He's not worried about selling a sneaker. He's not worried about having advertisements. So he'll say whatever he wants to say and live whatever the consequences are, and it produces interesting results.
Well, it's a great piece, and your work has been outstanding. Check him out on Twitter, at Sherwood Strauss. Go to The Athletic and check out Andre Iguodala, the curmudgeon, and future Hall of Famer, delivers again for the Warriors. Ethan Strauss, he covers the Warriors and the NBA for The Athletic. Kind enough to spend some time with us here on Fox Sports Radio. Ethan, we really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at noon Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific.
Andy Ruiz is your new undisputed heavyweight champion of the world, which, by the way, is interesting because I'm not sure how many people knew that Anthony Joshua was the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world before that. Did you guys know that? Like, we used to do, I've done this on my radio show for the last 15 years where you go like, hey, tell me who the undisputed or the heavyweight champion of the world is. So, look, Andy Ruiz is 29 years old. He only has one loss, right? Like, this guy is not a tomato can. He's fought 34 fights, won 33, 22 by knockout, only lost once. Only once. And that one was a majority decision for a heavyweight title belt, for the WBO heavyweight title belt, to Joseph Parker in New Zealand. Like, who knew? Like, this is a, I know it's a world of sport, but did anyone have any idea who Andy Ruiz was before he won on Saturday night? The answer is no. So Ruiz had to replace Gerald Miller. And he got to challenge Anthony Joshua, who is 22-0, 21 KOs. It's for the unified. I don't know if you guys know, there's just four belts. Because I saw the IG post. I was like, wow, there's four belts now? Yes, WBA, WBO, IBF, IBO. And it was because Jarrell Miller, who was supposed to fight, I think he failed PED tests, right? It's like he failed three different PED tests. So Ruiz, who's like, if you want to tell me he's on steroids, I'd be like, all right, well, steroids do not cut down on your body fat, right? So 1 month prior to the fight, they confirmed it, which is very, very close in advance. It was at Madison Square Garden in New York City. And I guess here's my question. Is it a great story or a terrible story? Now, let me pitch it to you, right? This is like a Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And maybe it's both. All right, here's the great story element to it. Had any of you ever heard of Andy Ruiz?
No.
No one had ever heard of him. And, like, look, he's considered, like, he fights basically under the Mexican flag, but I don't know if he's actually from Imperial Valley in California. That was where he was born. Now, he started fighting in Mexico. So he's, his 105 wins include two Mexican National Junior Olympics gold medals and the World Ringside Heavyweight Championship. He represented Mexico in two Olympic qualifying tournaments, losing in both of them. Like, here's a guy who tried to qualify for the Olympics in the Mexican flag, couldn't get there. Had one title fight, lost by majority decision, and was a replacement for a steroid guy to be a tomato can and fly the banner in Madison Square Garden. And he gets knocked down early in the fight, and he gets up, he knocks down Joshua four times before eventually it's TKO, and he wins. He's now the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. And he's 6'4", and, I mean, he's in shape if you consider round a shape. Out of nowhere, this is the old Cinderella story, 16th hole Augusta, right? That's what it feels like. I mean, he shouted out to his wife afterwards, "Don't worry, Mama, like, tough times are over, it's all worth it." There are crazy story after crazy story. Is this the most unlikely champion? And it's a feel good. Anybody can get in there. Here's a guy that looks like he could very easily be a tow truck guy, right? Like, hey, tow truck guy, come out here and fight. It looks more like Butterbean than he does the picture. And we're talking 2019. Anthony Joshua looks, if you want to tell me what an athlete looks like, like Deontay Wilder and Anthony Joshua, those are two men who look like they should fight for a heavyweight champion of the world. Championship of the world. And now this dude is your champion? What? It's an amazing, or is it a terrible story in that, I mean, the guy who is your champion was either so unprepared for what he was facing, had a terrible strategy where Ruiz just kept pushing towards him, just kept moving forward. And then, frankly, his hands were too quick. He didn't seem to have long arms or great reach. Great quick feet, great quick hands. You're like, that's the guy who represents your sport? I get it. Nice story, but we didn't actually want him to win. We wanted to be close. We wanted to be interesting, but we wanted the elegant fighter. We wanted Wilder against Joshua. That's already scheduled. That's already set. Now it doesn't mean anything. So I guess my question is this a great story? The Cinderella story, an unknown guy, Mexican heritage, replacement fighter. Anybody can win the heavyweight champion, or dude, your sport's a joke because literally feels like anyone can win it.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
Jim Jackson's a former lottery pick in the NBA. Mr. Basketball two times over, state of Ohio, All-American Ohio State. Great player in the NBA. Played for 12 different teams. And, of course, he's the lead analyst for basketball on Fox. And he's kind enough to spend some time with us here on the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. JJ, let's start with kind of my premise, which is, look, we can talk Steph. We can talk the boxing one. We can talk about Draymond or Iguodala, you know, stepping up, making a shot, maybe a little bit early in the shot clock than he had to, whatever. But third quarters are coaches' quarters, right? What do you change at halftime to make an adjustment? Since Steve Kerr has been there, they've been the best third quarter team in the NBA. Why doesn't anyone seem to be willing to give Steve Kerr credit for he and his staff making great adjustments and out-coaching people?
Well, I think it's real simple, Doug, because they have probably one of the most talented teams in the league. And conventional wisdom is people, well, you got the most talent, doesn't take much. They should be able to play, et cetera, et cetera. But I always say this, too. The challenge with having talent is just as much. The challenge is this. Too much talent is just as challenging as not enough talent. You got to figure out egos, time, minutes, hits the ball, all of that stuff. The adjustments that Steve Kerr makes, not only just in the third quarter, Doug, but the in-game adjustments, going to the side pick and roll, clearing out a strong side with Draymond and Steph at times in order to get a 3-on-2 situation on the backside. Those things right now, I think Steve Kerr doesn't get as much credit for because he has the talent, but the ability for a Golden State team, a championship team, to be able to focus a lot more on what they didn't do right in the first half to come out in the third quarter, dominate, is a testament to those champions.
All right, so what did they actually do defensively?
Well, I think they stopped taking chances. One, they got back on defense. They didn't give up any easy shots. Second, the open three-point shots, a lot of the looks that they were getting, giving up, they didn't give. I thought they communicated a lot more. They didn't get confused as much on their switches. That's where they gave up a lot of points, is when they came out on the pick and roll and they're going to switch, the bad guy didn't really talk. And that just gave Toronto some easy layup opportunities, or the ball was able to swing from side to side and they got an open jump shot or a quick swing and then a drive. I think that communication right there, that's where Golden State, to me, when they give up points, Doug, not really like a quick one-on-one drive. It's when they get into those situations where they have to switch and they don't communicate early, and then they end up getting beat with a backdoor cut or a jump shot over the top.
It was fascinating to watch. And then I thought offensively, they spread Toronto way out. They used Steph as a screener stum, and they weren't helping off of Steph. They played through the post as they so often do, this time through DeMarcus Cousins. And, you know, they get to what's called a split game where the guards screen for each other. And I thought they really kind of, if you're Toronto, like, look, if you lose giving up contested three-point shots, okay, but you lose giving up layups, and there were far too many wide-open layups on back cuts and splits than we had seen in the previous game, and I thought that was part of the adjustment they made offensively.
But, Doug, they've been doing this for the last 3 years. I mean, people get enamored with Golden State and the three-point shooting, the deep shots in transition, but where they really beat you when it counts, like making that third quarter run, they get back in games is when they get layups. Because like you said, they use Steph to set screen. Well, they use Clay in that same manner where you can't take a body off them. And guess what? It was a timeout in that third quarter. I thought it was when Golden State did a slip play, hit Draymond for the backdoor cut. Those little things, that's how they beat you. See, they're going to beat you over the top. They're going to get their looks at threes. Now, sometimes they're not going to shoot it well. They didn't shoot it particularly well from the three last night. But because you have to honor what they do offensively, they give up layups. And you know what the beauty of it is? DeMarcus can pass. Steph can pass. Klay can pass. Draymond can pass. When Durant is in there, he passes quick. So you have and Iguodala and Livingston. So you have six or seven players that are willing passers.
Boga can really pass.
And Boga can really pass. So that's what I'm saying. So, again, we can't get caught up into the three-point shoot. I think where Golden State is excellent is taking advantage of you overplaying and then going backdoor getting layups.
Yeah, they have so many guys with such great passing acumen.
Yes.
That's a skill, but it's one which I think they knew what they were doing. There was a time in the fourth quarter when they didn't have Klay, when he had Draymond, who's like a point center, right? He had Bogut, mm-hmm. who's like a point center and can really, really pass. He has Steph, who obviously can pass. And you mentioned Iguodala and Sean Livingston, who is a point guard, you know, his whole life until he got to Golden State and he took on this role. And, you know, more point guards, more passes, better shots, guys that read the floor better. And I thought that was a major difference in the game.
Well, real simple. Who made the pass to Iguodala to get the shot?
Livingston.
Sean Livingston. Yeah. And it may seem like simple, but in the heart of the moment, imagine if that pass was maybe down by Iguodala's feet or below his knees. It takes him more time to get that shot up. Maybe a defensive guy recovers. Taking pride in your passing means so much to a shooter, as you know, being a point guard, to get it to him where he's comfortable to be able to take it up and shoot it, but also being a willing passer, willing to give the ball up, knowing that I may have a good shot, and right now my teammate is open for a better shot. See, a lot of times, Dougie, people wanted to emulate a lot of stuff that Golden State has done offensively, but one thing they couldn't duplicate was the high IQ players that come at you. All of the guys that play for that come in and play significant minutes for Golden State, they have a high IQ. So you may lose some athleticism and maybe some talent when you go to the bench, but one thing that doesn't drop off is the IQ.
It's a great point. Jim Jackson joining us, Fox College basketball analyst, Doug Gottlieb Show here on Fox Sports Radio. On one side, you have a devastating loss, right? You have an early lead, you're playing well, you're at home, Klay goes down, Looney goes down, KD's down, and yet you still lose the game. On the other hand, like, Golden State is banged up. Like, this thing's held together by duct tape. But I just wonder, I understand NBA players are wired differently than the rest of the world, right? You have the ability, like, it's one loss, you get on a plane, you fly across country, the game's not till Wednesday, forget about it. It felt, well, though, like that one was bigger. That's like game one of last year's finals, where, you know, LeBron played his guts out and, you know, J.R. Smith has a bonehead move. Do you think there's carryover mentally, emotionally from game two to the rest of the series?
I think maybe a little bit. Here's the thing. I always thought game two, to me, Doug, was the most critical game for Toronto. And this being said, okay, say you drop game one. You get back game two, maybe you get your confidence back. Or you win two in a row. That gives you more confidence going into Golden State. I thought that Golden State sent the message that we can win here on the road, okay, for Toronto, who played so well on a high coming off that first game. I think it's going to be very difficult. Now, if the injury stays like it is, Doug, I think it's going to be difficult for Toronto to go into Golden State and win a game. I always felt that Golden State, if healthy, could go on the road and win and get home court advantage. So, experience-wise, this is when Toronto's going to lean on Danny Green, Kawhi Leonard, to kind of understand what it takes to go on the road after having a tough loss at home, regaining that and what the value of getting home court really means. So it has some lingering effects on it, but I think more than anything is the effect that you can't discount this Golden State team even when they're hurt. Even when they're hobbled, they still figure out ways to keep the game in balance, and then, bam, next thing you know, they're walking away with a W.
So if they're healthy, you think this thing's a wrap?
No, I've had that from the beginning. I thought Toronto would be a formidable foe. But here's my thing. I said this before, Doug. If Kevin Durant plays, okay, he and Kawhi, they cancel each other out. The second, third, and fourth best player play for whom?
The Warriors.
Yeah, exactly. So take KD out. insert Steph into that equation. So Steph and Kawhi cancel each other out. The second and third best players still play for who?
The Warriors.
Golden State. Hey, that's my point. And then you add Steve Kerr making adjustments and the ability to have players who played in championship caliber games and have that experience, that gives them, to me, the edge over a Toronto team that may be a little deeper, but yet and still, when it comes down to winning games, your best player's got to step up, and you're going to rely a lot more on Draymond and Clay than I think you are with Siakam and probably Marcus Gasol.
Did I lose him? Did we lose him, guys? I think we lost him. All right, Jim Jackson returns here to us on the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm too emotionally tied into it. I feel like KD, like he's in that locker room waiting for those guys. He's chomping the bit. Like, why would you leave this thing? Like, why wouldn't you just try and go win, keep winning championships? I don't understand the I need my own team thing.
Well, because Doug, you're not KD. I'm not KD. How he thinks. The things that have happened to him growing up that put him in this position, I can't dig into his mind. Like, for me, I never was in that position. So to be in a situation, to be on a championship team multiple times, I'm good with that. And I can get paid from there, too, and have a legacy. I didn't have that opportunity. For KD, it seems as he struggles with this. He wants to win. Yes, he got his championships, but he wants to be able to cement his legacy a little bit differently. Not piggybacking, so to speak, on all the success of Golden State, but maybe showing that he could do it. I don't know why that's a big thing, but again, that's what makes us all unique. What I like, what I think, is totally different than what drives and motivates a guy like Kevin Durant, who we think on the outside, hey, you should be happy with all that you accomplished. You're probably the greatest player in the world right now. You got two championships, multiple MVP honors,
finals MVPs, finals
MVPs, right. You know, but now, you know, it's this lingering question. And one thing I try not to do is dive into a mind of a person that's been through different circumstances and try to rationalize why they do or don't do anything. They'll tell us with their actions what their real motivation is.
That's a great point. Jim Jackson joining us on the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. I want to ask you something I know you're probably not prepared for, but you are prepared for. The Ruiz fight, right? The Ruiz fight over Joshua.
Oh, yeah. I'm a big fighter.
I know you are. First, I thought, I mean, like, he's way, because he's got a big belly, I think that if people didn't watch the fight, like, he's got unbelievable hands and feet for a man his size. But is that a good story for boxing or a bad story for boxing, right? Like, because Anthony Joshua and Deontay Wilder, like, they look like what a heavyweight champion in our mind. We should think, like, 6'4", 6'5", 6'6", 6'7", big dudes cut up, long, elegant, right? This guy looks like he was driving a truck in the morning. He's like, yeah, I'll fight tonight. And he ends up... is this a good story for boxing? Do you think this helps boxing or hurts?
I think it hurts from this perspective, because in the heavyweight division, you don't have the kind of matchups that are going to draw this kind of attention, this kind of, I think, excitement, even from the casual boxing fan that will tune in to watch these two heavyweights go at it. And I think that does hurt. You know, it's a lot different than when you had, I think, Buster Douglas and Mike Tyson. Buster, you know, may have been a journeyman a little bit, but he wasn't as bad as Ruiz, okay? He gave you something. But here's the thing about it, too. Going into the fight, and you're a boxer, it was still some, a boxing fan, there was still some questions about Joshua and his ability to finish off fight, especially in later rounds, or him getting susceptible to getting knocked down. So there were still a lot of questions on how good Joshua was anyway, going into this fight. Not that he should have lost the fight in a lot of people's minds, but not preparing. And then kind of answering a lot of questions, and Deontay Wilder chimed in and said, told you he's overrated, he wasn't ready. You know, he didn't have this, he wasn't that. You know what I mean? So coming into it, it was in the professional world, there were some questions on Joshua. But I do think in the short term, this fight was set up with Wilder to be it. You know what I mean? Heavyweight division coming back between two behemoths. And now it doesn't have the same shine on that he lost.
No, it really, really doesn't. But, you know, maybe the winner gets Ruiz, and then we get to...
You can sell it, though.
Yeah.
You can still figure... Listen, we live in a world of America. You can sell anything, okay? You can hype up anything. Joshua can come back and say, I wasn't focused, I wasn't prepared, but now I'm ready to go, blah, blah, whatever it is.
The promoters know how to get the interest going, because in boxing, especially on the heavyweight side, we still need something. We still need something that's going to grab our attention.
Well, it grabbed our attention. I just don't know if it holds. It's like an upset early. It's like an upset early in the NCAA tournament. Like, we think it's a good thing, but the truth is, like, the American sports fan wants Duke and Carolina, you know, and those type of teams, you know, and the Michigans and the Michigan State. That we want them.
But how
in.
Many, how many times have we done this? With a Mike Tyson fight, hype is over in the first round. But yet, yep. The next fight, it was the same thing. The next fight, it was just, you know what I mean? No, we know sometimes with that outcome, it may not be what we want. With Mayweather, we knew that the fights weren't going to be exciting. But yet, and still, it's a portion of the fans that say, listen, I want to see if he will lose this fight. Or I want to see if he continues his streak. And people still clicked on $99.99 to watch a pay-per-view fight.
I know. But then you walk away and you feel like such a sucker. You know, you're like, man, I'm never going to buy another Floyd Mayweather fight ever again until the next Floyd Mayweather fight I'm going
to
buy.
Into the next one. I'm telling you. You tell me if Manny Pacquiao and Mayweather come back here, you're not going to watch it?
Of course I'm going to watch it.
But that's what I'm saying.
And then my wife's going to go, really? You spent how much?
Exactly.
Really? Yeah. You did what? Really? Like, yeah.
Exactly. I know.
I did that.
I know. And if they schedule this Wilder, Josh will fight. Guess what? The storyline will be Josh, can he recover from a humiliating defeat and take back what was his? You know, stuff like that, the storylines. That's what we'll see.
Great stuff. Jim, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Anytime, Dougie.
All right, that's the one and only Jimmy Jackson joining us on the Doug Gottlieb Show here on Fox Sports Radio.